Welcome to the Seneca Podcast, a weekly discussion of current affairs in China, coming to you from the pop-up Chinese studio here in Beijing. I'm Kaiser Guo, and joining me is the valiant Jeremy Goldcorn, a.k.a. Jin Yu, the man behind Danwei.com, Zemyang Gomer.
A very good evening to you, Kaiser.
I understand that you spotted some interesting fauna here in Beijing last week.
I saw a wild hedgehog near the Lido area in Beijing. A wild hedgehog. It was a very heartwarming sight. A silway.
Now, what was it doing? And I mean,
it was foraging around a small bamboo grove. As soon as I saw it, it ran off.
Didn't know that they were... what do they taste like?
Not sure. Which is why I was so surprised to see it.
Anything that protects itself with a coat of spines must be tasty. Sea anemone theory. Today, we welcome back Alexa Olson, reporter for the Associated Press. How's it going, Alexa?
Hey, Kaiser. It's going very well. Thank you.
Great to have you back. Also, joining us again is the Wall Street Journal's Josh Chin. Great to have you back again. Josh, how are you?
Good. Good to be here, Kaiser.
So today we're looking at the big rainstorm that hit Beijing last Saturday night, the 21st of July, when it came down in buckets over a period of several hours, overwhelming Beijing's drainage systems and causing at least 37 deaths. The number of deaths, of course, is a matter of great controversy here. Many more have been rumored. On Wednesday morning, it was announced that the previous day, Beijing Mayor Guo Jinlong had stepped down as mayor, as had vice mayor of the capital, prompting many to leap to the apparently unfounded conclusion that the resignations were due to mishandling of the flooding. We'll look at the torrential rain and the torrent of criticism that's come after it with two reporters who've been following the story very closely. But first, let's do a roundup of the week's other big news, rebranded. I think we used to call it the Danwei Week. We're calling it the Seneca Week now.
We're calling it the Seneca Week, and it's not just a change of name. It's not... old wine in new bottles. The reason we're changing it is because instead of the poncy Danwei editors deciding what are the stories of the week, we're going to run through a number of stories and ask the Seneca guests to decide what are the most interesting stories.
They're decidedly not poncy.
They're not poncy. So hence, it's now called the Seneca Week. Should I get straight into it, Kaiser?
Well, what does poncy really mean?
It means sort of uptight, kind of, sort of a slightly
like a
effeminate,
yeah, so, yeah.
Upper-class
so
English man, I think. It's sort of what poncy is, really. No?
I mean, I know the word from Spinal Tap, you know, poncy hairdressers.
I too am from the colonies, maybe I've got the definition wrong. Let's get straight into it. So story number one, I don't think there'll be any question, and this is our main topic of the podcast tonight, is the floods in Beijing. Everyone agreed that
thumbs
is a major
up.
Story.
Of course, that's why we're making it.
So that's number one. So there are a bunch of different articles, and we can discuss some of them, but that's number one, floods in Beijing. Story number two, violence against doctors. An article, part one, I think, only has been published so far in The Economist about the growing problem in China of patients attacking, sometimes murdering doctors because they are dissatisfied with the treatment they're getting.
Growing problem indeed. And I think what's interesting there is that in at least one instance where a doctor was killed, was stabbed by a disgruntled patient, online reaction was actually supportive of the murderer, which is just bizarre to me.
If you've ever been to a Chinese hospital, one might understand
yeah,
why.
Yeah, but do we blame the doctors for this? I mean, ultimately, is it? I mean, I can understand
going after
a hospital
important.
Administrator, maybe.
What do you think of the story? Now, I mean, on a sort of meta level, it's not breaking news. It's not new news. The Economist, I don't think, really found out anything new, but they've brought some attention and perspective to the story.
I think it's a great story and needs more people to cover it. And I think it's a wonderful way to sort of sex up the healthcare story, which can be very difficult to write.
Right. Sex up the healthcare story.
Yeah. I mean, sorry
it
to sort
bleeds,
of.
Therefore it,
yeah,
it
I mean,
bleed.
I think it makes it a very sort of like, it gives it a very human angle. And of course, you know, healthcare is human, but this gives it a much more immediate sort of narrative. And right. So it's a great story to tell.
The healthcare story. Right. Now right. With blood and death.
Yeah.
So it cites some really interesting numbers, right? I mean, 17,000 instances of attacks in 2010, and that was up from 10,000 just 5 years ago. So what's causing this? Jeremy, why are people killing doctors?
Well, I'm actually going to refer to an article I know more thoroughly than the Economist article, which was something we posted on Danwei back in May, which was an article in the China Youth Daily, Zhongguo Qingnian Bao, about this very topic. And it basically seems to be people in hospitals themselves or their relatives and finding it just very difficult to get the treatment they think they need. And they're getting frustrated and they're running amok. They're going postal, literally. I think in China maybe we could translate going postal as going hospital.
Going medical.
And I mean, I think really anyone who has spent time in a Chinese hospital will understand why it might drive one crazy. You're sick and you have to run around between different dirty, filthy floors with bits of tickets, with hostile doctors and nurses who talk to you about your illness as though you've done something wrong, as though you've committed some kind of crime and that's why you're sick. It's really nasty. So this is becoming a growing problem. And there are now, in fact, new laws to say that hospitals must have a certain amount of security guards and equipment to deal with the problem.
Right. And the profit motive is such that, you know, they're recommending things for you that you might not need. And they're also demanding bribes of you, which, you know, are nowhere on the books. And you have no idea how to negotiate those bribes and sort of what the going rate is. I think it's all because it's so opaque. It's extremely frustrating.
But they're so badly underpaid. I mean, they're,
yes.
I think that, I mean, that's, I mean, I feel like that's the other side of the story that, in China, I mean, you think of doctors sort of universally across the world as at least decently paid, even in you know,
dodgy
bleeding
countries.
Heart socialist countries like the UK, you know, and in China, which not too long ago did actually have a communist state-run, basically free medical system, doctors have sort of basically still being paid on that scale.
Right, I mean, we're talking a few thousand yen a month, right?
You know, and they don't, and they work, they study just as hard as doctors anywhere else to get where they are, but they get paid.
They probably work harder because they're just more people.
Right.
And the other thing is that the patients themselves are, in fact, paying rates comparable, say, to Americans, because it's just that it's not all going to the doctors. Because step one is they're ticket scalpers to get you an appointment to see the doctor. So you pay the ticket scalper 200 kwai just to get a ticket to get an appointment. And then there are bribes and other fees and payments at every step along the way. So by the time you actually end up getting treated, even though the hospital fee itself might be relatively low, you've paid a bunch of other stuff.
So our verdict is this is a very worthwhile story, something that obviously is good fodder for further investigation and discussion.
Yeah.
Great. Let's move on to that next story that you had there, Jeremy, about shadow banking.
Story three, China shadow bankers go online as peer-to-peer sites boom. And that's on Bloomberg. And Kaiser, I think you understand this a lot better than I do, so perhaps you could explain it.
Sure. I mean, what's happening here is there are a number of websites, things like ppdai.com and rinrindai.com, Credit Ease. They're all similar to, for our American listeners, prosper.com. What happens here is that, you know, you do sort of peer-to-peer micro-lending, essentially, microfinance. A lot of these people claim to have been inspired by or even trained under Muhammad Yunus of the famous Grameen Bank in Bangladesh. All very, you know, good and noble. These are loans that are made to strangers without collateral, and China doesn't have a system of you know, personal credit rating. So you're doing this basically on the strength of an application, which very well might be fabricated. The other possibility is not just that the people who are recipients of loans may be absconding with the 200 kwai that you've loaned them, but also that the sites themselves may be set up. In the case of one that this article, it's a very excellent article by Luo Jun of Bloomberg, talks about, a company called TaoJinDai.com went under after only 5 days of operation with a million yuan in investments from about 80 users. So it looks into the hazards of this, but also the very, very clear need for us. And people last year were talking quite a bit about the Wenzhou underground banking sector, and this story suggests that a lot of people who were loan sharking are now sort of taking this to these sites where they can be charging pretty exorbitant rates of interest, 18% in some cases, and taking the business there and sheltering under the sort of legitimacy of these sites, the assumption being if government regulators crack down, it won't be on the lenders themselves, but on the operators of the websites. Interesting story, guys?
Well, my first question is, if it weren't online, what would it look like? It would be like a sort of storefront, and you would walk in and fill out a form, and they'd give you money.
I mean, right, or it would be a sort of shady deal made
over a Wenzhou cafe.
In a Wenzhou cafe, exactly.
But it's all very sort of small scale.
Yeah, I mean, I think in the case of this is this there are very positive incidents that are cited in this as well. I mean, it's not at all a takedown piece on this whole industry. One woman who's interviewed in this is actually she talks about having plowed a lot of money into had made a really recent investment, so she had no liquidity at all. And then having a really serious medical condition come up, and she was able to raise enough money from these, you know, peer-to-peer lenders to be able to get treatment. So it wouldn't always necessarily take that sort of scary, I'm going to break your legs form. But,
right. Yeah. I was about to say, is anyone getting killed? Because if someone's getting killed in the story, then it's interesting to me. But
There's no violence.
Okay, so.
Well, not to play the stereotype of the wonky Wall Street Journal reporter here, but actually, I think this is kind of a fascinating story in some ways. It says a lot about kind of China's economy and the way it's set up. And how, in some ways, the game is rigged against
small
little people.
Right, small, right,
you know, I mean, the entire story behind Wenzhou and the entire shadow banking industry, which is, I mean, shadow banking sounds about as cool
nefarious.
As banking gets.
Sounds like shadow boxing.
But exactly. But you know, I mean, the whole impetus behind this industry in Wenzhou is that big banks in China essentially don't lend to anyone but state-owned enterprises.
No, they don't. And I mean, as a kind of, you know, bootstrapping type entrepreneur, I've actually tried to. I mean, the Bank of China laughed at me twice on two separate occasions. Two separate managers laughed at the fact that I even thought that I should waste 10 minutes going down to the Bank of China branch to ask for a loan. It was just ridiculous.
Oh, you know, people call me all the time to ask me if I need a loan. I mean, next time.
But no, I think this is the sort of story that is like it's a crucial thing for China going forward. You know, I mean, how are they going to do this? I mean, people, you know, the small and medium sized enterprises, like, you know, individual people who are trying to make a living and earn a little bit of cash. I mean, they drive a huge part of this economy and a lot of the employment in this country, and they get basically no financial support. They're kind of out there on their own, and they're forced to go. I mean, it used to be back alley deals where they might get their legs broken if they didn't pay it back. I mean, this is a little bit more.
Why is it always the legs?
I don't know. It is always the legs. I mean,
Josh, if you do follow up on this, if you guys do a follow up on something like this, one thing that I felt like I was missing from the Bloomberg piece was just a clear sense of what the regulatory realities are regarding this. I mean, I think it's of course it's like so many things. It's in a gray area, but I feel like there were good interviews with CBRC people, you know, talking specifically about how you're regulating online lending, or maybe it'd be a good addition to the story.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, it's very possible they have no idea. I mean, this is like could be a classic China thing where this has just happened and like no one has any idea what to say about it.
There's no category for it.
Right.
Can I complain about something, Mr. Bloomberg? He's looking at you. But the Wall Street Journal is getting better. The New York Times is not really great, but slowly improving. Links. You know, there's a whole story about P2P lending in China. It's on the web. There are links, but no links. This is an absurdity of the traditional media, and I'm not blaming Alexa and Josh, our guests, because the policies aren't set by you, but it's pretty bad.
I totally agree.
You guys are pretty good, I gotta say.
Well, on the blog, I mean,
blog, you're very good.
Yeah. I mean, that's something directly under my control, but I've been yelled at by editors.
Don't link to your sources.
Keep linking to the Baidu beat. Anyway, sorry. Anyway,
let's move on.
Yeah.
Story four: CNOOC agrees 61% premium. Basically, China's largest foreign acquisition is possibly going to happen.
Largest foreign acquisition of a listed company.
Of a listed company. So CNOOC is going to buy Nexen, a Canadian Calgary-based oil company.
Oil and natural gas, right? Yeah. I mean, obviously, this is of tremendous interest, right?
Yeah. I mean, it's China resource drive going out. I mean, this is, and it's a huge victory for one of China's big state-owned oil companies.
Is it a foregone conclusion that it goes through now?
Well, actually, no. That's a good point. It's not a foregone conclusion.
But Canadians are a little more enthusiastic about China than the Americans.
A little more flexible,
right?
Well,
the
North Dakotans aren't happy about it. There's resistance in the lower 48 now to this. I mean, memories of Unocal and then all sort of anti-China stuff in the air. I can't remember who it was, but there was somebody, a North Dakota politician, who is raising Cain over this and making it some sort of an issue. I can't imagine how they have any say in the matter. I mean, Canada, last time I checked, was a sovereign nation, so...
Right, despite what some people in the United States might think otherwise. Yeah, I mean, it sounds like to me, you know, I mean, I think the thing to remember with this, too, is that it is an election year. So even if, you know, Washington or people in the U.S. have no say over the deal, it wouldn't be surprising if there were a little bit of noise made on the southern side of the border. But
so on that note, let's move on.
Wait, I guess there's one.
Sounds very, very important. And where's the ringer? Like, where's the story where we're like, oh, no, that should never be written about? Do we have one of those coming up?
No, before we get to the levity for the week, there is one little thing at the end of the piece, Jeremy, that you sent me. Where was this? Where did this run? I'm spacing
the interview
out.
With the...
No. It was still on Nexon.
Still on Nexon. Right. The one I sent you was in the FT.
Right. Oh, right. That's right. It was in the FT. At the end of that piece, there's also mentioned that Sinopec is paying $1.5 billion for a half stake, for a 50% stake, in the North Sea assets of another Calgary-based extractive company called Talisman Energy.
Talisman Energy, what a name. That's very kind of James Bond villain.
That sounds like something a New Age woman would say to me.
That's almost cooler than shadow banking. In fact, I think it may be cooler than shadow banking.
Talisman Energy.
Okay, and on to some fun now.
Okay, so to round off, two quick stories that we're going to quickly talk about. It's the death of Ding Guanggun, the former head of propaganda. I don't think that's fun, but I think we should note that, although, I don't know, you might feel differently. I don't think that should actually be a story of the week, but note it. The Asia Society had a post on it.
A long period of silence, censorship.
Shall we observe?
Silence.
I actually know a Ding Guanggun joke, but I'm not going to bother telling it. It's actually a Jiang Zemin joke, but Ding Guanggun is sort of in there. But he figures in the story as in this joke as a smart guy. He actually had a reputation for having quite an intellect, in spite of his having run the propaganda office.
Well, I think he set the direction of current public opinion guidance. I think they're still basically following his model, as I understand it. So he's somebody who perhaps is worth looking at when trying to understand contemporary China.
Okay.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Maybe I'll write out the joke and put it up online.
I think you should.
I should.
Okay, finally, let's look at Capitol Blues. Embattled Washington, D.C. mayor Vincent Gray tells Foreign Policy what he admires about Beijing. Did you guys read that?
I did.
Isaac Stonefish, yes. Former Beijing resident, was one of the interviewers. What did you think?
It was Mayor Gray's Tom Friedman moment.
I mean, I think as an interview, it was pretty fantastic. I mean, it was sort of unvarnished, just an American politician kind of spitting it all out there, you know, without anyone. Yeah. No one was there to sort of tell him, no, you can't say that.
Yeah, his PR guy
was
not in the room with him. I would have been there going, no.
It was pretty fantastic. I mean, it was almost kind of...
Where was Ding Guanggun then?
Yeah, exactly. Where was Ding Guanggun when you need him?
Exactly.
Characterize this for us. I mean, he was basically... doing another, you know, oh my God, I was so blown away by the infrastructure and they get things done so quickly. And, you know,
yeah, why don't we have a bit of authoritarianism around America kind of vibe, I think.
He walks it back at the end, right?
He does
says,
walk it
I still,
back.
You know, I love democracy.
But
they oppress people over there. You know, we can't have that. Authoritarianism without repression, yeah.
All right, so we got to decide. What are the three stories? Floods, we've decided.
Absolutely.
Is number one. Then there's violence against doctors in The Economist.
It leads, it bleeds.
Mm-hmm. Then there's shadow bankers go online in Bloomberg.
Interesting story, but I think if I have a say in this, I would put the Sinopec acquisition ahead of that.
Yeah, I think I would as well.
Okay, so Sinopec acquisition. What about Capitol Blues, the embattled Washington, D.C. Mayor Vincent Gray tells FP? What do you
think? It's not a story, it's an amusement.
It's an amusement. Ding Guanggun, historical footnote for scholars, not newsy people.
Yeah,
no.
That's right.
So we've got Sinopec, violence against doctors, and floods hit Beijing.
And speaking of the floods, that's our main topic for today. So let's dive right into that. Let me just tell you what my first reaction when I started. I mean, let's all talk about where we were on Saturday. I mean, I got I had a good time. I was wading through a lot of water, walking to back from the subway station after visiting my folks with my kids, who were just having a good old time. But it was calf deep water. But I had no inkling at the time that the damage would be as extensive as it was. Of course, the damage was mostly in areas outside of municipal or of urban Beijing. Right, it was in the Fangshan district, 20 kilometers or so southwest of Beijing. Did you guys have a sense that night about?
I had no idea.
Yeah.
And not until Sunday night did right. I hear that people had died. And then I was shocked. Like, how? Josh, how did that happen?
Yeah.
Yeah. No, I was, I was mostly in the center of the city. And then I had an interview up in Wudalco where it was coming down, coming down pretty hard, but nothing, I figured by the end of the interview it'd be over. It wasn't. I thought that was kind of weird. Still went out to dinner in Sanlitun. But the only weird thing was a friend who actually miraculously did come out to meet me for dinner, had ridden his scooter from the east, and where some people did die in their cars, and in Chaoyang, and was describing stuck buses and waist deep water, which is the first sort of inkling that actually might have been a little bit worse than I thought. But yeah, I went home and didn't really think about it till the next day.
Well, I think partly is because people might not realize this, but in Beijing, it was just sheeting down rain, but it wasn't that kind of windy, violent storm.
Right.
It was just very heavy rain. Just,
yeah, nice.
And very consistent for a long time.
For a long time, yeah.
For like 24 hours, basically, it rained, right?
I've seen 16 hours and 20 hours, depending on
16 to 20, depending on where you were.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I mean, my first reaction to the early coverage, though, of the story was like, does every incident that gets people really riled up on Weibo have to be interpreted by the English Language Foreign Correspondent Corps as some kind of existential crisis of legitimacy for the party? I mean, but then, I started thinking, now we've got this mayor resigning, and it looks like, and then I find out, of course, that the resignation was in the works for a long time, that he's been promoted actually to party secretary. And so how do we make sense of all this? I mean, is this a crisis of legitimacy in some sense?
Well, I think when people, regular people, pile on online and criticize the government and say this is unacceptable, I mean, I think that storyline comes from the reaction from average people. They were really furious. How could rain like that, which was, yes, a lot and consistent, but it wasn't violent, how could it cause so much damage and so many deaths? And that shouldn't happen.
I mean, even if it's not a crisis, I mean, maybe a crisis of legitimacy seems, if that seems a little bit hard, at the very least, there are credibility issues, which I think you saw kind of coming out with the death toll numbers, right? So that, I mean, they came out with the death toll. First it was 10 on early Sunday, and then late Sunday night it was 37, and it's been 37 since late Sunday night, and we're now into Thursday. And if you've been out to the suburbs and you've seen the damage out there, it definitely seems like there's got to be more.
Right. I mean, there were people posting things on Weibo, most of which were taken down pretty quickly, but there were photos, for example, of what was alleged to be a retirement home, an old age home, Yangaoyue, in Fangshan, which supposedly had 200 grandmothers and grandfathers, as it was described, that was completely washed away. I have no idea whether that is true.
For what it's worth, we did call around, and we couldn't find any retirement homes that had more than 150 people. So it sounds that might be fake. But the main point is how quickly or almost immediately people started doubting the numbers, right? And which to me sort of says that, I mean, that is a crisis of credibility. If as a government you come out after a disaster and you say this is how many people are dead, and almost immediately, within a couple hours, people saying no, I don't think so, and then that becomes the main topic of conversation, is whether you're telling the truth or not. Yeah, that points to, at the very least, a credibility issue that I think is part of this.
I think is a credibility issue. The thing is, I don't think it's new. I think one of the problems in some of the English reporting on this kind of thing is, like, Wenzhou last year was, in some ways, the really big one on the internet.
Sure.
And I think the reaction to Wenzhou was much fiercer than currently we're seeing about the Beijing floods. But people tend to assume, okay, Chinese people bitching about the government online and saying, you know, a crisis of credibility or even legitimacy, you know, they tend to think that it's new, and it's not new by any means. But what Weibo particularly has done, and the internet in general, has made it very easy for us to have a peek in and see what people are thinking, whereas before you wouldn't be able to do that. But, I mean, nobody in China has ever believed official death toll statistics. I mean, this goes back to Emperor Qin Shi Huang. I mean, we've got thousands of years of disbelief of official death toll figures. So
right.
It's not actually as significant as it sometimes is made out to be.
Well, what we were writing about today is, I think what is different is that people have the ability now to say, I don't believe that death toll. I'm going to find out the real one. And people are organizing. So you have on Baidu a page set up, sort of like a chat room set up, of Fangshan residents who say, tell us what your death toll is, and we're going to compile this. And then there's people down in Sichuan who are also doing the same thing. And so you've got crowdsourcing of the death toll, and people are having this realization that I can do it if the government's not going to do it for me. And if they have that realization, then you would think there would be a knock-on effect. There would be other things where they're like, well, if the government isn't serving me the way I want to, you know, we'll do it ourselves.
Along those lines, I mean, I think a really interesting thing from a sort of civil society standpoint. Mm-hmm. I mean, this idea of if the government's not going to do it, we'll do it ourselves is the, the warnings for yesterday's rainstorm. Which was, one of the big knocks on Beijing was that they didn't, people were saying that they didn't send out warnings. They didn't really tell people how bad the storm was going to be.
Right.
There was supposed to be a storm last night, and to the government's credit, they did send out messages. But then beyond that, you had all kinds of crazy organizations, businesses sending out their own, right. Like
my powerhouse gym.
Yeah,
sent me
powerhouse gym. I have a
Tim
friend
Ferriss.
Whose dentist sent him a note. You know, I mean, basically,
it's kind of like SARS. SARS was the last time that kind of thing was going on, right?
Yeah. Right.
2003, right. Severe acute.
The great freakout though came to sort of this anticlimax when yesterday a lot of people converged at some of the points, like in Guangxiumen. Where there were fatalities because of the very deep flooding under the underpasses, cameras trained on these places. I mean, there were a lot of people. There's great pictures on Weibo of this.
Chinese journalists.
Yeah, Chinese journalists, and of course
waiting for the flood.
It didn't rain. Right,
that didn't happen. Right. Well, they should have been in Tianjin because that's where the rain went.
Right, yeah. The rain went to Tianjin, and was Tianjin municipality any better prepared for it?
I haven't heard of fatalities. So, I mean, that's...
I mean, the photos are sort of limited use, but from the images that I've seen out of Tianjin, it looked like people were sort of almost having fun with it. I mean, there was an image of a guy rolling around downtown Tianjin on a jet ski.
And one thing about the criticism of the government that I don't... It sits a little uncomfortably with me, I think, is that... You know, I'm always the first person to criticize the Communist Party and the government for not being transparent and for, you know, always fucking with the media and generally being nasty. But I don't think it's possible to develop a city at the pace that Beijing has developed without this kind of thing happening. I mean, in 1990, there were 10 million people living in Beijing. You know, now they're
22.
You know, you can take your number, but 22 million is one number that a lot of people go with. In 1990, there was really not even one real skyscraper in Beijing. Now, no cars. Everybody was on bicycles. Now everybody's driving around on brand new roads, lined by brand new skyscrapers, and you know, mixed up with really shoddy buildings built from before 1949, or really shoddy buildings built in the Great Leap Forward, or really shoddy buildings built in the Cultural Revolution,
or in the
shoddy
90s.
Buildings built in the 80s or 90s. Exactly. I mean, this is going to happen. You can't have this breakneck development without this kind of disaster happening. And you can clean up corruption and open the media and do this and that and be great and, you know, turn the Communist Party into saints overnight. It's still going to happen unless things slow down.
But then, that's the question, you know, that I can imagine someone asking. And this, I mean, in this situation is, if Beijing is covering up, if Beijing is really, if there are more people who are dead than 37, I mean, it's a classic cover up being worse than the crime situation, right? I mean, it sounds like now that if you look online, the vast majority of the criticism and the anger is about
the alleged numbers, cover up, right?
The Beijing sewer system and whether it needs to be upgraded. I mean,
That was the first day's complaint.
Right.
And speaking of which, I mean, I think the most common type of comment that I saw was, to your point, this isn't a visible sort of vanity project kind of thing. I mean, you know, you don't see the sewers, right, or you don't see the drainage system, so they never prioritized it. It wasn't, you know.
Well, and it's not real estate that you can sell.
Right.
It's public works that you have to, you know, pour money into and you don't get it back.
And I saw an awful lot of pictures posted of Tokyo's rather impressive. I have to, oh my God. I mean, I had seen in a, our VP at Baidu had shown it to us at an internal meeting once, just photos of this, you know, asking us to guess what it is. I mean, it's this colossal. I mean, it's like 40 feet tall and these gigantic concrete pillars. It looks like, you know, a Babylonian temple or something. It's crazy, but I'm...
Well, they have typhoons. They're prepared. Another thing about Beijing is that it's so dry. It's so dry. But, you know, part of me wonders whether or not... It feels to me like Beijing's climate has actually changed last couple of decades. And I wonder whether or not... Beijing's not prepared because there was no need before for any kind of flood control because you didn't have this sort of torrential rainpour. And it was, you know, it's the first in 60 years of this level.
We've decided that the floods of Beijing 2012, July, are the story of today. But we didn't actually fix on a particular report about it. And the Real China Real Time blog had a really good summary of it. I know that I think it was the most comprehensive summary. And The Economist had a pretty good blog post. But if I was going to go for a story, I think I'd highlight the Shanghai Daily had a little piece yesterday about a company which is state-owned company called the Beijing Drainage Company. So their job is draining Beijing. And clearly they failed because 37 people died.
It's the Soviets' fault, right?
This story said that the spokesperson for this company blamed Soviet urban planning and said that, you know, their equipment and stuff wasn't to blame. What was to blame was Soviet urban planning. So, I mean, I think that's kind of really... you know, passing the buck. But one of the things I thought very interesting about this article was it mentioned that there was some shame because Xinhua had reported that some of the ancient waterworks in Beijing, the Yuan possibly, but definitely Ming and Qing waterworks, had not flooded or anything. And I personally observed some of this because I was cycling on Sunday after the storm on one of the canals that feeds into Beijing, the Xibahe, which I think is the remnant in the same course of at least a Ming channel. It wasn't flooded. It was fine, right?
Well, Liangmahe, the next day, I rode my bike past Liangmahe, the river that runs kind of through the northeast of Beijing, and it was full. I mean, it was fuller than I've ever seen it, but it didn't seem to have burst its banks.
So things have gone backwards in the drainage sense since the Ming Dynasty in Beijing.
Right. Well, the two hardest hit areas, I guess you could say, were within the city, those underpasses. That's the most vulnerable spot. And then in Fangshan, which is, you know, not at all like downtown Beijing, as I'm sure very
mountainous
different.
Mountainous and very poor.
Mountainous, poor, single-story buildings. I haven't gone out there. I don't know if, Josh, did you go out there?
Yeah, I went out there on Monday, actually. And it was, I mean, it's essentially not. I mean, it's described as suburban Beijing, but it's not suburban in any sense of that any American would understand.
Rural.
I mean,
it's villages.
It's villages and it's mountains. I mean, it's mountain villages.
And
so,
steep mountains are the really crumbly rocks, right?
Right. I think that the story of the flood out there, which I mean, if the death toll does officially go up, it will mostly be, I think, out there. It's much more of a natural disaster in that case. It's not. I mean, the story there is not that the infrastructure wasn't there. Instead, the story will be whether the response from the, you know, if there's a criticism that the government didn't get out there quick enough and hasn't been willing to admit.
Jeremy, you raised the point that 20 years ago there weren't cars, there weren't a lot of privately owned automobiles. Most of the drivers on the road today, as we can all attest, are still pretty new at it. Alexa, you talked about the underpasses being the point of vulnerability where a lot of the fatalities in urban Beijing took place. How many of these were just because people didn't know better than to drive their cars into flooded underpasses?
You know, the Darwin Award should be awarded to many motorists in Beijing, and you know, I don't want to cast light on any tragedy, but you've got to believe that some of those deaths were caused by people who just don't know how to drive.
There were some pretty tragic-ass things, though, like the guy who was
Ding, 34-year-old editor.
Exactly.
Yeah, on Second Ring Road. Yeah.
That was very, very sad.
I think he was there in the underpass
already. What happened?
I think what happened,
he was already in the underpass.
Is that you've got traffic and you're stuck. And so it wasn't that they drove into the water, but that they were in that spot. Traffic
gridlocked.
Would lock them in, and then
his electrical system died, and he couldn't unlock his... He couldn't roll down his windows at that point.
And he didn't have any hard object to shatter the glass.
So he did. I mean, he should have known that the headrest, he could have pulled the headrest out.
How many people know that except for now?
Yeah,
I mean, only
I didn't
now
know
after
that
the viral Japanese.
I also didn't know until today that you're supposed to wait until the car is totally submerged and then you should be able to open the door easily.
Right.
So that apparently is a strategy, but then you have to be completely submerged and wait for the pressure to be relieved.
Well, what I do know is that the last news item I read before leaving my office today was that, of course, some entrepreneur has sprung up, and there's apparently a run on emergency escape hammers on Taobao.
Right.
It's the new hot product.
This is
you guys,
Beijing.
Yeah.
This
Journal.
Is like iodized salt.
Oh, you've covered that, did you, Josh?
Do tell.
Yeah,
well, I mean, it's just like, yeah, exactly. It's like with any other, it's very reminiscent
of the Fukushima.
Explosion when rumors spread that the radiation was coming, it was going to pollute all the salt supplies, and that it was going to, you know,
people buying guns after Aurora and not going to theaters.
Right. So it was panic buying, but basically there was one tool, survival tool in particular, called the Rescue Me or something like that. It's a keychain basically has a hammer, kind of like a, you know, hardened, I think, diamond coated sort of hammer-like thing, and then also a blade to cut your seatbelt. So and it's basically all about escaping cars, and that has sold. I mean, it's the number, at least yesterday was the number two selling tool on all of Taobao. I can't remember what number one was, but also I heard we weren't able to confirm, but I also heard that it sold out on Amazon in the U.S. and that was Chinese people ordering it from the U.S. because they couldn't find it on Amazon here. And they were worried about the Shanghai. They were worried about fake Rescue Me supplies in China.
They're actually only coated in cubic zirconia.
Right, exactly. Right. Exactly. So
and can't break glass, and that would just be tragic.
Right. Indeed. But, I mean, the big revelation in all of this, too, for me, is that you can break a window, supposedly, with a headrest, which I did not know.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk very quickly about the resignation of Guo Jinglong. Are we now all of the opinion that said absolutely nothing to do whatever with the handling of the floods?
No. I don't know. I mean, maybe not, but I mean, the whole thing is a bit
no,
fishy.
Maybe.
So,
well, wait, come down somewhere. I'm not sure where you are right now.
Well, I think the resignation happened, I'm getting lost on time, this morning? Yesterday morning.
Yeah.
Yesterday morning.
So that would be Wednesday morning.
It was a little dramatic, the mayor and the vice mayor resigning at once at this time. I think one shouldn't necessarily discount any theory at this point.
Well, I mean,
I think it was a scheduled.
Yeah, it was just a scheduled thing, was it?
That's,
I mean, he's
sense.
Now party secretary of Beijing.
Right.
I mean, which
is But there were a bunch of newspapers which had Beijing mayor resigning. So for many Lao Bai Xing, many common people, all you will see is there were people died in floods, and then that's on Monday the headline.
Yeah, you know,
and then on Tuesday the headline is the Beijing mayor and vice mayor resigned.
Right.
And then on Wednesday there's like some chick flashing her tits at a car show, and you forget everything. So I think that one should not discount this particular line of thinking. No.
No, I apologize. Sorry about the vocabulary. No, I mean, I think the timing is incredibly peculiar. I mean, why if you're – yes, so Guo Jinlong and the vice mayor, Ji Lin, they were both promoted earlier in the month to positions on the party committee. Guo is going to become the party chief, which is a promotion. Everyone knew this was happening. And maybe he was supposed to give up his mayorship or maybe not. I don't know.
His successor was already anointed.
Right. I mean, it's yes, this was. We knew this was going to happen at some point. But I mean, on the other hand, Guo was the
point person on the flood.
He was out there. Right. I mean, there were the photos of him eating fang bian mian with all the other people.
Instant noodles.
This is China. Nobody resigns because it's the right thing to do. It's a message of some kind.
I don't know.
Exactly the message is, I'm not sure. But
I think this is a case of him having. As they say, as the Chinese idiom says, having tied his shoes in a melon patch or stretched in a peach orchard, where, you know, there's the appearance of some sort of impropriety, but I think I'm fairly convinced that the two had nothing to do with one another.
Yeah,
well, I think there's a lot of people who read the Beijing Wanbao yesterday and are satisfied that somebody has been blamed and held responsible for the floods.
Let's take this outside.
And now he's the big boss. Now he's the even bigger boss in Beijing.
That wasn't reported. The headlines were the mayor and vice mayor resign. The headline was not Beijing mayor promoted.
This is true.
That was in the media. The statement Beijing Erbao.
It's possible.
The Beijing party paper. So
it's possible that in doing so, they could sort of at the same time offer up a sacrificial goat. Is that the word? Lamb.
But it's a fiction because they're actually still in power and actually have more power.
More power, in fact.
But which has happened before, though. I mean, I'm blanking on names, but some of the officials involved in the melamine scandal a couple of years ago did pop up. Years later, in higher positions,
sure.
Right? It's not unheard of.
It's a shell game, right. You know. Don't be so naive. It's a shell game. Come on, I mean, this is it's like distract the people. It's smoke and mirrors. Mm. There is a very definite strategy to this. It's not coincidence that the Beijing mayor and vice mayor resign 2 days after a deadly flood. Come on, this is a country of political theater.
Do you think maybe it was just on the calendar, and instead of being sort of aware of how this might play out in public opinion, they were completely tone deaf to how, you know, it was going to be received, and they just said, "Well, it's on the calendar. We need to do this now."
That's a story as well, though. The government, a government in charge of one of the world's most important capitals, being so tone deaf that they would look at the calendar and say, "Oh, time
Let's
for the mayor
anyway.
To go." You know, even though we're in the middle of possibly our biggest crisis since 2003.
I'm sorry. I'm always a believer in the incompetence of the Chinese government and their ability to be completely tone deaf, especially when it comes to foreigners.
But I'm going with the tone deafness.
This is China. This news was digested by Chinese people. These headlines were crafted by experienced propagandists. You know,
but what actually changes? You know.
Okay, hey guys, we have to wrap. Let's move on to the recommendations segment. but good discussion. Thanks. Let's
all note just here, for I'm the panda hugger today. I've been defending the Beijing government.
Well,
and I'm
going
to break Jeremy's legs.
I'm here to offer you all shadow loans. Josh, why don't you go first? Do you have something for us this week?
I do. I'm going to this one is actually it's a book. It's in Chinese. Good practice for pop-up users. It's a book by the founder of Ctrip, the travel.
Oh, right.
The online travel website, Liang Zhenzhang, and has nothing to do with travel. It's about China's one-child policy.
Really?
And it's a very, very interesting book. Basically, the story is that he got interested in this when he was doing a PhD in economics at Stanford, which he's, I think, just finished up or is finishing up. And he looks at it from the angle of entrepreneurship. And creativity in business.
Looks at the one-child policy from the angle of entrepreneurship, creativity.
It's sort of interesting. I mean, basically, his idea is that because of the one-child policy, partly because of the one-child policy, China's population is aging rapidly. Is in a few years going to face a situation in which there are very few young people being forced to support a lot of old people. which is happening in Japan and other places, Europe as well.
And I think this is impetus for...
And what got him into this was he read a study that found that the vast majority of great business innovation, great entrepreneurs, and technological innovation happened, was done by people who were in their 30s. Between 25 and 35, I think, somewhere in that range.
Mm-hmm.
And he kind of looked at China and realized that very quickly that was not going to be the case, that those people were not going to be dominant in China and that they were going to be distracted by trying to support their older generations and that this was going to be a huge problem if China was to be an advanced economy. Whether that theory holds or not, I don't know. But that's how he got interested in it, and he basically spent most of his time at Stanford studying sort of the economic impacts of the one
demography and innovation.
Exactly. Yeah. So very. I mean, it's an interesting take.
The title of the book in Chinese.
It's 中国人太多吗?
Are there too many Chinese?
Which I think that's probably the interesting thing, right? It's sort of taken for granted in China. I mean, everyone in China is thinks that.
Default
everyone
response says, to any problem in China.
Yeah, exactly. Everywhere you go, exactly. It's the Meibanfa idea, right? So I mean, that's the whole
good recommendation. I'm actually being too lazy to plow through a whole book in Chinese. I'm going to wait for the English translation.
There are charts.
Oh, those charts. Oh, yeah. Good. The charts.
Maybe an audiobook. That would be helpful. How many times has Paul French's book already been recommended?
Many times.
Never enough.
Okay,
enough for Paul French.
We had Paul on to talk about the book, if you'll recall. And so after Alexa's recommendation, rather than go read it, just go listen to Paul on... We did a one. It's called Midnight in Peking.
You know, Paul's a very short guy. He's got kind of a short man's complex. So anything you can do to boost his ego, like recommending his book, is a very good thing.
There's a backstory there, I guess. I was going to recommend actually that people do the audio walk. People may have read the book but haven't actually gone out and done the audio walk yet. And you should download to your iPod the audio walk, and there's a map, and you can do it. It takes 2 or 3 hours, and I think that is something that people should do.
And that basically takes you on a tour of the area where the book is set.
Right. So from the Fox Tower where the woman was found murdered.
Where I got married, right?
Oh, okay. Huh. or where Kaiser got married. My second recommendation, it's not a book, it was an audio walk, is Abigail Washburn's album that came out last year.
She's great. Abby's
City of
great.
Refuge. So,
anyone who doesn't know who she is, she's this brilliant banjo player, Abigail Washburn, who spent quite a bit of time in China, speaks very good Chinese, sings many songs in Chinese, has played many a gig with the wife of our dear Jeremy here.
Yeah, they actually, Abby and my wife, have a band together.
Yes, they do.
Which kind of performs when they're on the same continent.
She's also, she's married unbelievably to probably the most famous banjo player
in the universe.
In the whole, in the entirety of the universe, whose name is...
Bella Fleck.
Bella Fleck, of course. I had too many beers tonight here.
But this album has no Chinese on it, but it's great. It's sort of on constant rotation on my iPod right now.
Oh, cool. Yeah. I will definitely get that. What's it called?
City of Refuge.
City of Refuge. Yeah. Not about Beijing, which is City of Refuse. Okay.
All right. I've want to recommend something that is probably not new to a lot of Seneca listeners, but I've become kind of hooked on recently as I've been doing a lot of cycling, which is the China History podcast.
Oh, I've recommended that very recently.
You have?
Yeah, but go again. I mean,
Think that I should, because this is a podcast, so anyone listening to this probably likes podcasts. And so Laszlo Montgomery, who's podcasting from the lovely town of Claremont in Southern California, which is, he's making sound very attractive to me. It's a series of podcasts about Chinese history from ancient legendary times all the way through to pretty much right now. Each podcast is 20 to 30 minutes. It's popular history told from Laszlo's own particular point of view. So sometimes there are things he says which I think, I'm not sure if I agree with that. But it's really the most entertaining way that I've experienced of digesting Chinese history. And it's very, very thoroughly researched.
That's right. He brings really good erudition to bear on these
absolutely
things.
I mean, he's absolutely thoroughly researched. You know, they're really very well sourced, I think. So,
and I must say now because of, you know, our mutual sort of
circle jerking
here, we've done. We've been in touch now, and he's an absolute mensch.
Like,
I mean, he's just such a gentleman. He's, and his Chinese is fabulous. He's great. So yeah, I'm all for. I second that endorsement.
And there will be links to all of these on the website.
Of course, there will be. I get to go now, though. Mine is to something I hope that you've all seen already, which is the Aspen Ideas Festival debate between Eric Exley and Min-Xin Pei, moderated by James Fallows, on China and democracy. I mean, except for the fact that Eric Exley keeps saying, well, I'm a venture capitalist. I mean, it's actually pretty – they both make some pretty solid points. What's interesting, though, is that the audience there is clearly persuaded by Eric Exley, which I think many people would find deeply disturbing, because, you know, he is championing this idea of a single party state being sort of a better alternative, and I think maybe it's the time we live in right now where the flaws of America's two party system are on conspicuous display every day in our broadsheets, but. The thing that I think we all need to realize about Eric Exley is he is probably the most articulate proponent of this new, you know, China single party state apologism out there, and, you know, he's their first sword, and those of us who take issue with that, and I would count myself as one, need to know how to fence with this guy, need to know how to parry and riposte with this particular swordsman.
Well, I mean, that's part of what's so fascinating about it. I mean, it's been so. I mean, China's state propaganda in defense of its own system has been so ham-handed. It's almost kind of, you know, it's sort of not even sporting to pull it apart. Whereas Eric Exley is, I mean, he puts forward a convincing argument. I mean,
it's deft.
Is deft.
Yeah.
And what does that X stand for?
We don't know.
Nobody knows.
It's the X factor. That's what makes him so deft. Without the X, he'd be unmanned.
Apparently. Yeah, it's not quite.
Yeah, it doesn't do it. Anyway, hey, Josh, thank you for coming. Alexa, thanks for coming.
Thanks, Kaiser.
Thanks.
Jeremy, we'll see you again next. Actually, I'm gone for 2 weeks in Southern California, and Jeremy, you're going to have the helm. Don't get up, man. All right, hey, thanks, and we'll see you next week on the
Frank Leo. Frank Leo, calling Frank Leo. We are open for investment over the next 2 weeks at special time.
Hey, Eric Exley is a venture capitalist. Okay, see you guys. Bye-bye.